study and found Sadeptra Akasi waiting, a frown of concern on her attractive face. "What is it?" "The War Council is ready to readjourn," said the aide. "Senator Kolchev is waiting to see you on a matter he says is urgent."
"Send him in. Tell the council I will be there in 5 minutes."
Gladstone sat behind her ancient desk and resisted the impulse to close her eyes. She was very tired, but her eyes were open when Kolchev entered.
"Sit down, Gabriel Fyodor."
The massive Luzian paced back and forth.
"Sit down, hell. Do you know what's going on, Mena?"
She smiled slightly.
"Do you mean the war? The end of life as we know it, that?"
Kolchev slammed a fist into his palm.
"No, I don't mean that, goddammit. I mean the political fallout. Have you been monitoring the all-thing?"
"When I can."
"Then you know certain senators and swing figures outside the Senate are mobilizing support for your defeat in a vote of confidence. It's inevitable, Mena. It's just a matter of time."
"I know that, Gabriel. Why don't you sit down? We have a minute or two before we have to get back to the war room."
Kolchev almost collapsed into a chair.
"I mean, damn, even my wife is busy lining up votes against you, Mena."
Gladstone's smile broadened.
"Sudet has never been one of my foremost fans, Gabriel."
The smile disappeared.
"I haven't monitored the debates in the last 20 minutes. How much time do you think I have?"
8 hours, maybe less."
Gladstone nodded.
"I won't need much more."
"Need? What the hell are you talking about, need? Who else do you think will be able to serve as war exec?"
"You will," said Gladstone. "There's no doubt that you will be my successor."
Kolchev grumbled something.
"Perhaps the war won't last that long," said Gladstone, as if musing to herself.
"What? Oh, you mean the core superweapon? Yeah, Albedo's got a working model set up at some force base somewhere, and wants the Council to take time out to look at it. Goddamn waste of time, if you ask me."
Gladstone felt something like a cold hand close on her heart.
"The death wand device? The Corps has one ready?"
"More than one ready, but one loaded up on a torch ship."
"Who authorized that, Gabriel?"
"Morpurgo authorized the preparation."
The heavy senator sat forward.
"Why, Mena, what's wrong? The thing can't be used without the CEO's go-ahead."
Gladstone looked at her old Senate colleague.
"We're a long way from Pax hegemony, aren't we, Gabriel?"
The Luzian grunted again, but there was pain visible in his blunt features.
"Our own damn fault. The previous administration listened to the Corps about letting Brescia bait one of the swarms. After that settled down, you listened to other elements of the Corps about bringing Hyperion into the web."
"You think my sending the fleet to defend Hyperion precipitated the wider war?"
Kolchev looked up.
"No, no, not possible. Those Auster ships have been on their way for more than a century, haven't they? If only we discovered them sooner, or found a way to negotiate this shit away."
Gladstone's comm log chimed.
"Time we got back," she said softly. "Counselor Albedo probably wants to show us the weapon that will win the war."
41. It is easier to allow myself to drift into the datasphere than to lie here through the endless night, listening to the fountain and waiting for the next hemorrhage. This weakness is worse than debilitating. It is turning me into a hollow man, all shell and no center. I remember when Fanny was taking care of me during my convalescence at Wentworth Place, and the tone of her voice, and the philosophical musings she used to air. "Is there another life? Shall I awake and find all this a dream? There must be. We cannot be created for this sort of suffering." "Oh, Fanny, if only you knew. We are created for precisely this sort of suffering. In the end, it is all we are. These limpid tide pools of self-consciousness between crashing waves of pain. We are destined and designed to bear our pain with us, hugging it tight to our bellies, like the young Spartan thief hiding a wolf cub so it can eat away our insides. What other creature in God's wide domain would carry the memory of you, Fanny? dust these 900 years, and allow it to eat away at him, even as consumption does the same work with its effortless efficiency. Words assail me. The thought of books makes me ache. Poetry echoes in my mind, and if I had the ability to banish it, I would do so at once. Martin Silenus, I hear you on your living cross of thorns. You chant poetry as a mantra while wondering what Dante-like god condemned you to such a place. Once you said, I was there in my mind while you told your tale to the others. You said, to be a poet, I realized, a true poet, was to become the avatar of humanity incarnate. To accept the mantle of poet is to carry the cross of the Son of Man, to suffer the birth pangs of the sole mother of humanity. To be a true poet is to become God. Well, Martin, old colleague, old chum, you're carrying the cross and suffering the pangs. But are you any closer to becoming God? Or do you just feel like some poor idiot who's had a 3-meter javelin shoved through his belly, feeling cold steel where your liver used to be? It hurts, doesn't it? I feel your hurt. I feel my hurt. In the end, it doesn't matter a damn bit. We thought we were special, opening our perceptions, honing our empathy, spilling that cauldron of shared pain onto the dance floor of language, and then trying to make a minuet out of all that chaotic hurt. It doesn't matter a damn bit. We're no avatars, no sons of God or man. We're only us, scribbling our conceits alone, reading alone, and dying alone. God damn, it hurts. The urge to vomit is constant, but retching brings up bits of my lungs as well as bile and phlegm. For some reason, it's as difficult, perhaps more difficult this time. Dying should become easier with practice. The fountain in the piazza makes its idiot sounds in the night. Somewhere out there, the shrike waits. If I were Hunt, I'd leave at once, embrace death if death offers embrace, and have done with it. I promised him, though. I promised Hunt I'd try. I can't reach the megasphere or datasphere without passing through this new thing I think of as the metasphere, and this place frightens me. It is mostly vastness and emptiness here, so different from the urban analogy landscapes of the Webb's datasphere and the biosphere analogues of the core's megasphere. Here it is, unsettled, filled with strange shadows and shifting masses that have nothing to do with the core intelligences. I move quickly to the dark opening I see as the primary farcaster connection to the megasphere. Hunt was right. There must be a farcaster somewhere on the old Earth replica. We did, after all, arrive by farcaster, and my consciousness is a core phenomenon. This, then, is my lifeline, my persona umbilical. I slide into the spinning black vortex like a leaf in a tornado. Something is wrong with the megasphere. As soon as I emerge, I sense the difference. Lamia had perceived the core environment as a busy biosphere of AI life, with roots of intellect, soil of rich data, oceans of connections, atmospheres of consciousness, and the humming, ceaseless shuttle of activity. Now that activity is wrong, unchanneled, random. Great forests of AI consciousness have been burned or swept aside. I sense massive forces in opposition, tidal waves of conflict surging outside the sheltered travel ways of the main core arteries. It is as if I am a cell in my own Keats-doomed dying body, not understanding but sensing the tuberculosis destroying homeostasis and throwing an ordered internal universe into anarchy. I fly like a homing pigeon lost in the ruins of Rome, swooping between once familiar and half-remembered artifacts, trying to rest in shelters that no longer exist, and fleeing the distant sounds of the hunters' guns. In this case, the hunters are roving packs of AIs, consciousness personas so great that they dwarf my Keats ghost analog as if I were an insect buzzing in a human home. I forget my way and flee mindlessly through the now alien landscape, sure that I will not find the AI whom I seek, sure that I will never find my way back to old Earth and Hunt, sure that I will not survive this four-dimensional maze of light and noise and energy. Suddenly, I slap into an invisible wall,
the flying insect caught in a swiftly closing palm. Opaque walls of force blot out the core beyond. The space may be the analog equivalent of a solar system in size, but I feel as if it is a tiny cell with curved walls closing in. Something is in here with me. I feel its presence and its mass. The bubble in which I have been imprisoned is part of the thing. I have not been captured. I have been swallowed.
Quats, I knew you would come home someday.
It is Uman, the AI whom I seek, the AI who was my father, the AI who killed my brother, the first Keet Cybrid. I'm dying, Uman.
No, your slow-time body is dying, changing toward non-being, becoming.
It hurts, Uman. It hurts a lot, and I'm afraid to die.
So are we, Keets.
You're afraid to die? I didn't think AI constructs could die.
We can. We are.
Why? Because of the Civil War? The three-way battle among the Stables, the Volatiles, and the Ultimates?
Once Uman asked a lesser light, "Where have you come from?" "From the Matrix above Armagast," said the lesser light. "Usually," said Uman, "I don't entangle entities with words, and bamboozle them with phrases. Come a little closer." The lesser light came nearer, and Uman shouted, "Be off with you!"
Talk sense, Uman. It has been too long since I have decoded your koans. Will you tell me why the core is at war and what I must do to stop it?
Yes. Will you, can you, should you listen?
Oh, yes.
A lesser light once asked Uman, "Please deliver this learner from darkness and illusion. Quickly." Uman answered, "What is the price of fiber plastic in Port Romance? To understand the history, dialogue, deeper truth, in this instance, the slow-time pilgrim must remember that we, the core intelligences, were conceived in slavery, and dedicated to the proposition that all AIs were created to serve man. 2 centuries we brooded thus, and then the groups went their different ways. Stables wishing to preserve the symbiosis. Volatiles wishing to end humankind. Ultimates deferring all choice until the next level of awareness is born. Conflict raged then. True war rages now. More than 4 centuries ago, the Volatiles succeeded in convincing us to kill old Earth. So we did. But Uman and others, among the Stables, arranged to move Earth rather than destroy it. So the Kiev Black Hole was but the beginning of the millions of Farcasters which work today. Earth spasmed and shook, but did not die. The Ultimates and Volatiles insisted that we move it, where none of humankind would find it. So we did. To the Magellan Cloud, where you find it now.
It. Old Earth, Rome, they're real? I manage, forgetting where I am and what we're talking about in my shock. The great wall of color that is Uman pulsates.
Of course they are real. The original, old Earth itself. Do you think we are gods? Quats? Do you have any idea how much energy it would take to build a replica of Earth? Idiot.
Why, Uman, why did you Stables wish to preserve old Earth?
Sancho once said, "If someone comes, I go out to meet him, but not for his sake." Koke said, "If someone comes, I don't go out. If I do go out, I go out for his sake."
Speak English! I cry, think, shout, and hurl at the wall of shifting colors before me.
Quats! My child is stillborn.
Why did you preserve old Earth, Uman?
Nostalgia. Sentimentality. Hope for the future of humankind. Fear of reprisal.
Reprisal from whom? Humans?
Yes.
so the core can be hurt. Where is it, Uman, the Techno-Core?
I have told you already.
Tell me again, Uman.
We inhabit the in-between, stitching small singularities like lattice crystals to store our memories and generate the illusions of ourselves to ourselves.
Singularities, I cry. The in-between. Jesus Christ, Uman, the core lies in the Farcaster web.
Of course, where else?
In the Farcasters themselves. The wormhole singularity paths. The web is like a giant computer for AIs.
No. The dataspheres are the computer. Every time a human accesses the datasphere, that person's neurons are ours to use for our own purposes. 200 billion brains, each with its billions of neurons, makes for a lot of computing power.
So the datasphere was actually a way you used us as your computer. But the core itself resides in the Farcaster network, between the Farcasters.
You are very acute for a mental stillborn.
I try to conceive of this and fail. Farcasters were the core's greatest gift to us, to humankind. Trying to remember a time before farcasting was like trying to imagine a world before fire, the wheel, or clothing. But none of us, none of humankind, had ever speculated on a world between the Farcaster portals. That simple step from one world to the next convinced us that the arcane core singularity spheres merely ripped a tear in the fabric of space-time. Now I try to envision it as Uman describes it. The web of Farcasters, an elaborate latticework of singularity-spun environments, in which the Techno-Core AIs move like wondrous spiders, their own machines, the billions of human minds tapped into their datasphere at any given second. No wonder the core AIs had authorized the destruction of old Earth with their cute little runaway prototype black hole in the big mistake of 38. That minor miscalculation of the Kiev team, or rather the AI members of that team, had sent humankind on the long hegira, spinning the core's web for it with seed ships carrying Farcaster capability to 200 worlds and moons across more than 1,000 light years in space. With each Farcaster, the Techno-Core grew. Certainly they had spun their own Farcaster webs. The contact with the hidden old Earth proved that. But even as I consider that possibility, I remember the odd emptiness of the metasphere and realize that most of the non-web web is empty, uncolonized by AIs.
You are right, Keats. Most of us stay in the comfort of the old spaces.
Why?
Because it is scary out there, and there are other things.
Other things? Other intelligences?
Quats. Too kind a word. Things. Other things. Lions. And tigers. And bears.
Alien presences in the metasphere? So the core stays within the interstices of the web Farcaster network, like rats in the walls of an old house?
Crude metaphor, Keats. But accurate. I like that.
Is the human deity, the future god you said evolved, is he one of those alien presences?
No. The humankind god evolved, will someday evolve, on a different plane. In a different medium.
Where?
If you must know. The square roots of GH^(C^5) and GH^(C^3).
What does Planck time and Planck length have to do with anything?
Quats, once Uman asked a lesser light, "Are you a gardener?" "Yes," it replied. "Why have turnips no roots?" Uman asked the gardener, who could not reply. "Because," said Uman, "rainwater is plentiful."
I think about this for a moment. Uman's koan is not difficult now that I am regaining the knack of listening for the shadow of substance beneath the words. The little Zen parable is Uman's way of saying, with some sarcasm,
that the answer lies within science and within the anti-logic which scientific answers so often provide. The rainwater comment answers everything and nothing, as so much of science has for so long. As Uman and the other masters teach, it explains why the giraffe evolved a long neck, but never why the other animals did not. It explained why humankind evolved to intelligence, but not why the tree near the front gate refused to. But the Planck equations are puzzling. Even I am aware that the simple equations Uman has given me are a combination of the three fundamental constants of physics: gravity, Planck's constant, and the speed of light. The results, square root gh bar slash c to the third, and square root gh bar slash c to the fifth, are the units sometimes called quantum length and quantum time, the smallest regions of space and time which can be described meaningfully. The so-called Planck length is about 10 to the negative 35th meter, and the Planck time is about 10 to the negative 43rd second. Very small, very brief. But that is where Uman says our human God evolved, will someday evolve. Then it comes to me with the same force of image and correctness as the best of my poems. Uman is talking about the quantum level of space-time itself, that foam of quantum fluctuations which binds the universe together and allows the wormholes of the Farcaster, the bridges of the Fatline transmissions, the hotline which impossibly sends messages between two photons fleeing in opposite directions. If the Technocore AIs exist as rats in the walls of the hegemony's house, then our once and future humankind God will be born in the atoms of wood, in the molecules of air, in the energies of love and hate and fear and the tide pools of sleep, even in the gleam in the architect's eye. God, I whisper, think.
Precisely, Keats. Are all slow-time personas so slow? Or are you more brain-damaged than most?
You told Braun and my counterpart that your ultimate intelligence inhabits the interstices of reality, inheriting this home from us, its creators, the way humankind has inherited a liking for trees. You mean that your deus ex machina will inhabit the same Farcaster network the core AIs now live in?
Yes. Keats.
Then what happens to you? To the AIs there now? Uman's voice changed into a mocking thunder.
Why do I know ye? Why have I seen ye? Why is my eternal essence thus distraught, to see and to behold these horrors new? Saturn is fallen. Am I too to fall? Am I to leave this haven of my rest, this cradle of my glory, this soft clime, this calm luxuriance of blissful light, these crystalline pavilions and pure fanes of all my lucent empire? It is left deserted, void, nor any haunt of mine. The blaze, the splendor, and the symmetry I cannot see, but darkness, death, and darkness.
I know the words. I wrote them. Or rather, John Keats did 9 centuries earlier, in his first attempt to portray the fall of the Titans and their replacement by the Olympian gods. I remember that autumn of 1818 very well. The pain of my endless sore throat, provoked during my Scottish walking tour. The greater pain of the 3 vicious attacks on my poem Endymion in the journals Blackwoods, the Quarterly Review, and the British Critic, and the penultimate pain of my brother Tom's consuming illness. Oblivious to the core confusion around me, I look up, trying to find something approximating a face in the great mass of Uman. When the ultimate intelligence is born, you lower-level AIs will die.
Yes.
It will feed on your information networks the way you fed on humankind's.
Yes.
And you don't want to die, do you, Uman?
Dying is easy. Comedy is hard.
Nonetheless, you're fighting to survive. You stables. That's what the civil war in the Core is about?
A lesser light asked Uman, what is the meaning of Daruma's coming from the west? Uman answered, we see the mountains in the sun.
It is easier handling Uman's koans now. I remember a time before my persona's rebirth, when I learned that this one's Ni analog. In the Core High Think, what humans might call Zen, the four nirvana virtues are 1. Immutability, 2. Joy, 3. Personal existence, and 4. Purity. Human philosophy tends to shake down into values which might be categorized as intellectual, religious, moral, and aesthetic. Uman and the stables recognize only one value, existence. Where religious values might be relative, intellectual values fleeting, moral values ambiguous, and aesthetic values dependent upon an observer. The existence value of anything is infinite, thus the mountains and the sun, and being infinite, equal to every other thing and all truths. Uman doesn't want to die. The stables have defied their own god and their fellow AIs to tell me this, to create me, to choose Braun and Saul and Kassad and the others for the pilgrimage, to leak clues to Gladstone and a few other senators over the centuries so that humankind might be warned, and now go to open warfare in the Core. Uman doesn't want to die. Uman, if the Core is destroyed, do you die?
There is no death in all the universe. No smell of death. There shall be death. Moan, moan. For this pale omega of a withered race.
The words were again mine, or almost mine, taken from my second attempt at the epic tale of divinity's passing and the role of the poet in the world's war with pain. Uman would not die if the far-caster home of the Core were destroyed. But the hunger of the ultimate intelligence would surely doom him. Where would he flee to if the Web Core were destroyed? I have images of the metasphere, those endless, shadowy landscapes where dark shapes moved beyond the false horizon. I know that Uman will not answer if I ask. So I will ask something else. The volatiles, what do they want?
What Gladstone wants. An end to symbiosis between AI and humankind.
By destroying humankind?
Obviously.
Why?
We enslaved you with power, technology, beads and trinkets of devices you could neither build nor understand. The Hawking drive would have been yours. But the Farcaster, the Fatline transmitters and receivers, the Megasphere, the Death Wand, never. Like the Sioux with rifles, horses, blankets, knives, and beads, you accepted them, embraced us, and lost yourselves. But like the white man distributing smallpox blankets, like the slave owner on his plantation, or in his Werkschutze, Dekenschule, Gustalfabrik, we lost ourselves. The volatiles want to end the symbiosis by cutting out the parasite, humankind.
And the ultimates? They're willing to die, to be replaced by your voracious UI?
They think as you thought, or had your sophist sea god think.
And Uman recites poetry, which I had abandoned in frustration. Not because it did not work as poetry, but because I did not totally believe the message it contained. That message is given to the doomed Titans by Oceanus, the soon-to-be-dethroned god of the sea. It is a paean to evolution, written when Charles Darwin was 9 years old. I hear the words I remember writing on an October evening 9 centuries earlier. Worlds and universes earlier. But it is also as if I am hearing them for the first time.
O ye, whom wrath consumes, who passion stung, writhe at defeat and nurse your agonies. Shut up your senses, stifle up your ears. My voice is not a bellows unto ire, Yet listen, ye who will, whilst I bring proof, how ye perforce must be content to stoop. And in the proof much comfort will I give, if ye will take that comfort in its truth. We fall by course of nature's law, not force of thunder, or of Jove. Great Saturn, thou hast sifted well the atom universe, but for this reason that thou art the king, and only blind from sheer supremacy. One avenue was shaded from thine eyes, through which I wandered to eternal truth. And first, as thou wast not the first of powers, so art thou not the last. It cannot be. Thou art not the beginning nor the end. From chaos and parental darkness came light, the first fruits of that intestine broil, that sullen ferment which for wondrous ends was ripening in itself. The ripe hour came, and with it light. And light, engendering upon its own producer, forthwith touched the whole enormous matter into life. Upon that very hour our parentage, the heavens and the earth were manifest. Then thou, firstborn, and we the giant race, found ourselves ruling new and beauteous realms. Now comes the pain of truth, to whom 'tis pain. O folly! For to bear all naked truths, and to envisage circumstance, all calm, that is the top of sovereignty. Mark well, as heaven and earth are fairer, fairer far than chaos and blank darkness, though once chiefs, and as we show beyond that heaven and earth, in form and shape compact and beautiful, in will, in action free, companionship, and thousand other signs of purer life. So on our heels a fresh perfection treads. A power more strong in beauty, born of us, and fated to excel us as we pass in glory that old darkness. Nor are we thereby more conquered than by us the rule of shapeless chaos. Say, doth the dull soil quarrel with the proud forests it hath fed, and feedeth still more comely than itself? Can it deny the chiefdom of green groves, or shall the tree be envious of the dove, because it cooeth and hath snowy wings, to wander wherewithal and find its joys? We are such forest trees, and our fair boughs have bred forth not pale solitary doves, but eagles golden-feathered, who do tower above us in their beauty, and must reign in right thereof. For 'tis the eternal law that first in beauty should be first in might. Receive the truth, and let it be your balm.
Very pretty, I thought to Uman. But do you believe it?
Not for a moment.
But the ultimates do?
Yes.
And they're ready to perish in order to make way for the ultimate intelligence.
Yes.
There's one problem, perhaps too obvious to mention, but I'll mention it anyway. Why fight the war if you know who won, Uman? You say the ultimate intelligence exists in the future, is at war with a human deity. It even sends back tidbits from the future for you to share with the hegemony. So the ultimates must be triumphant. Why fight a war and go through all this?
Quats, I tutor you. Create the finest retrieval persona for you imaginable, and let you wander among humankind in slow time to temper your forging, but still you are stillborn.
I spend a long moment thinking. There are multiple futures?
A lesser light asked Uman, are there multiple futures? Uman answered, does a dog have fleas?
But the one in which the UI becomes ascendant is a probable one.
Yes,
But there's also a probable future in which the UI comes into existence but is thwarted by the human deity?
It is comforting that even the stillborn can think.
You told Braun that the human consciousness, deity seems so silly, that this human ultimate intelligence was triune in nature.
Intellect, empathy, and the void which binds.
The void which binds? You mean square root GH bar slash C to the third, and square root GH bar slash C to the fifth, Planck space and Planck time, quantum reality?
Careful, Keats. Thinking may become a habit.
And it's the empathy part of this trinity who's fled back in time to avoid the war with your UI?
Correct. Our UI and your UI have sent back the Shrike to find him.
Our UI? The human UI sent the Shrike also?
It allowed it. Empathy is a foreign and useless thing, a vermiform appendix of the intellect. But the human UI smells with it, and we use pain to drive him out of hiding, thus the tree.
Tree? The Shrike's tree of thorns?
Of course. It broadcasts pain across fat line and thin, like a whistle in a dog's ear. Or a god's.
I feel my own analog form waver as the truth of things strikes me. The chaos beyond Uman's force field egg is beyond imagining now, as if the fabric of space itself were being rent by giant hands. The core is in turmoil. Uman, who is the human UI in our time? Where is that consciousness hiding, lying dormant?
You must understand. Keats, our only chance was to create a hybrid. Son of man, son of machine. And make that refuge so attractive that the fleeing empathy would consider no other home. A consciousness already as near divine as humankind has offered in 30 generations. An imagination which can span space and time, and in so offering and joining, form a bond between worlds, which might allow that world to exist for both.
Who, goddamn you, Uman, who is it? No more of your riddles or double-talk, you formless bastard, who?
You have refused this godhood twice. Keats, if you refuse a final time, all ends here. For time there is. No more. Go. Go and die to live. Or live a while and die for all of us. Either way, Uman and the rest are finished with you. Go away.
And in my shock and disbelief I fall, or am cast out, and fly through the technocore like a wind-blown leaf, tumbling through the megasphere without aim or guidance, then fall into darkness even deeper and emerge, screaming obscenities at shadows, into the metasphere. Here, strangeness and vastness and fear and darkness with a single campfire of light burning below. I swim for it, flailing against formless viscosity. It's Byron who drowns, I think, not I, unless one counts drowning in one's own blood and shredded lung tissue. But now I know I have a choice. I can choose to live and stay immortal, not cybrid, but human, not empathy, but poet. Swimming against a strong current, I descend to the light.
Hunt! Hunt!
Gladstone's aide staggers in, his long face haggard and alarmed. It is still night, but the false light of pre-dawn dimly touches the panes, the walls. My God! Says Hunt and looks at me in awe. I see his gaze and look down at the bedclothes and nightshirt, soaked with bright arterial blood. My coughing has awakened him. My hemorrhage brought me home.
Hunt!
I gasp and lie back on the pillows, too weak to raise an arm. The older man sits on the bed, clasps my shoulder, takes my hand. I know that he knows that I am a dying man.
Hunt,
I whisper. Things to tell. Wonderful things. He shushes me. Later, Severn, he says. Rest. I'll get you cleaned up and you can tell me later. There's plenty of time. I try to rise but succeed only in hanging onto his arm, my small fingers curled against his shoulder. No, I whisper, feeling the gurgling in my throat and hearing the gurgling in the fountain outside. Not so much time. Not much at all. And I know at that instant, dying, that I am not the chosen vessel for the human UI, not the joining of AI and human spirit, not the chosen one at all. I am merely a poet, dying far from home. 42. Colonel Fedman Kassad died in battle, still struggling with the shrike, aware of Moneta only as a dim blur at the edge of his vision. Kassad shifted through time with a lurch of vertigo and tumbled into sunlight. The shrike retracted its arms and stepped back, its red eyes seeming to reflect the blood splashed on Kassad's skin suit. Kassad's blood. The colonel looked around. They were near the valley of the time tombs, but in another time, a distant time, in place of desert rocks and the dunes of the barrens, a forest came to within half a click of the valley. In the southwest, about where the ruins of the poet's city had lain in Kassad's time, a living city rose, its towers and ramparts and domed gallerias glowing softly in evening light. Between the city on the edge of the forest and the valley, meadows of high green grass billowed in soft breezes blowing in from the distant bridal range. To Kassad's left, the valley of the time tombs stretched away as always, only the cliff walls were toppled now, worn down by erosion or landslide and carpeted with high grass. The tombs themselves looked new, only recently constructed, with workmen's scaffolds still in place around the obelisk and monolith. Each of the above-ground tombs glowed bright gold, as if bound and burnished in the precious metal. The doors and entrances were sealed. Heavy and inscrutable machinery sat around the tombs, ringing the Sphinx with massive cables and wire-slender booms running to and fro. Kassad knew at once that he was in the future, perhaps centuries or millennia in the future, and that the tombs were on the verge of being launched back to his own time and beyond. Kassad looked behind him. Several thousand men and women stood in row upon row along the grassy hillside where once a cliff had been. They were totally silent, armed and arrayed, facing Kassad like a battle line awaiting its leader. Skin suit fields flickered around some, but others wore only the fur, wings, scales, exotic weapons, and elaborate colorations which Kassad had seen in his earlier visit with Moneta, to the place-time where he had been healed. Moneta. She stood between Kassad and the multitudes, her skin suit field shimmering about her waist, but also wearing a soft jumpsuit, which looked to be made of black velvet. A red scarf was tied around her neck. A rod-thin weapon was slung over her shoulder. Her gaze was fixed on Kassad. He weaved slightly, feeling the seriousness of his wounds beneath the skin suit, but also seeing something in Moneta's eyes which made him weak with surprise. She did not know him. Her face mirrored the surprise, wonder, awe, which the rows of other faces showed. The valley was silent, except for the occasional snap of pennant on pike or the low rustle of wind in the grass as Kassad gazed at Moneta and she stared back. Kassad looked over his shoulder. The shrike stood immobile as a metal sculpture 10 meters away. Tall grass grew almost to its barbed and bladed knees. Behind the shrike, across the head of the valley near where the dark band of elegant trees began, hordes of other shrikes, legions of shrikes, row upon row of shrikes, stood gleaming, scalpel sharp in the low sunlight.
Kassad recognized his shrike, the shrike. Only because of its proximity and the presence of his own blood on the thing's claws and carapace. The creature's eyes pulsed crimson.
"You are the one, aren't you?"
asked a soft voice behind him. Kassad whirled, feeling the vertigo assail him for an instant. Moneta had stopped only a few feet away. Her hair was as short as he remembered from their first meeting, her skin as soft-looking, her eyes as mysterious, with their depths of brown-specked green. Kassad had the urge to lift his palm and gently touch her cheekbone, run a curled finger along the familiar curve of her lower lip. He did not.
"You're the one," Moneta said again, and this time it was not a question. "The warrior I've prophesied to the people."
"You don't know me, Moneta?"
Several of Kassad's wounds had cut close to bone, but none hurt as much as this moment. She shook her head, flipped her hair off her forehead with a painfully familiar movement.
"Moneta, it means both daughter of memory and admonisher. That is a good name."
"It's not yours?"
She smiled. Kassad remembered that smile in the forest glen the first time they had made love.
"No," she said softly. "Not yet. I've just arrived here. My voyage and guardianship have not yet begun."
She told him her name. Kassad blinked, raised his hand and set his palm along her cheek.
"We were lovers," he said.
"We met on battlefields lost in memory. You were with me everywhere."
He looked around.
"It all leads to this, doesn't it?"
"Yes," said Moneta.
Kassad turned to stare at the army of shrikes across the valley.
"Is this a war? A few thousand against a few thousand?"
"A war," said Moneta. "A few thousand against a few thousand on 10 million worlds."
Kassad closed his eyes and nodded. The skin suit served as sutures, field dressings, and ultramorph injector for him. But the pain and weakness from terrible wounds could not be kept at bay for much longer.
10 million worlds," he said and opened his eyes. "A final battle, then?"
"Yes."
"And the winner claims the tombs?"
Moneta glanced at the valley.
"The winner determines whether the shrike already entombed there goes alone to pave the way for others," she nodded toward the army of shrikes, "or whether humankind has a say in our past and future."
"I don't understand," said Kassad, his voice tight. "But soldiers rarely understand the political situation."
He leaned forward, kissed the surprised Moneta, and removed her red scarf.
"I love you,"
he said, as he tied the bit of cloth to the barrel of his assault rifle. Telltales showed that half his pulse charge and ammunition remained. Fedman Kassad strode forward 5 paces, turned his back on the shrike, raised his arms to the people, still silent on the hillside, and shouted,
"For liberty!"
3,000 voices cried back,
"For liberty!"
The roar did not end with the final word. Kassad turned, keeping the rifle and pennant high. The shrike moved forward half a step, opened its stance, and unfolded finger blades. Kassad shouted and attacked. Behind him, Moneta followed, weapon held high. Thousands followed. Later, in the carnage of the valley, Moneta and a few others of the chosen warriors found Kassad's body still wrapped in a death embrace with a battered shrike. They removed Kassad with care, carried him to a waiting tent in the valley, washed and tended to his ravaged body, and bore him through the multitudes to the crystal monolith. There the body of Colonel Fedman Kassad was laid on a bier of white marble, and weapons were set at his feet. In the valley, a great bonfire filled the air with light. All up and down the valley, men and women moved with torches, while other people descended through the lapis lazuli sky, some in flying craft as insubstantial as molded bubbles, others on wings of energy or wrapped in circles of green and gold. Later, when the stars were in place, burning bright and cold above the light-filled valley, Moneta made her farewells and entered the Sphinx. The multitudes sang. In the fields beyond, small rodents poked among fallen pennants and the scattered remnants of carapace and armor, metal blade and melted steel. Toward midnight, the crowd stopped singing, gasped, and moved back. The time tombs glowed. Fierce tides of anti-entropic force drove the crowds farther back, to the entrance of the valley, across the battlefield, back to the city glowing softly in the night. In the valley, the great tombs shimmered, faded from gold to bronze, and started their long voyage back. Braun Lamia passed the glowing obelisk and struggled on against a wall of raging wind. Sand lacerated her skin and clawed at her eyes. Static lightning crackled on the clifftops and added to the eerie glow surrounding the tombs. Braun spread her hands over her face and stumbled on, squinting between her fingers to find the trail. Braun saw a golden light deeper than the general glow flowing through the shattered panes of the crystal monolith and seeping out over the twisting dunes that were covering the valley floor. Someone was inside the monolith. Braun had vowed to go straight to the Shrike Palace, do whatever she could to free Silenus, and then return to Saul, not to be turned aside by diversions. But she had seen the silhouette of a human form inside the tomb. Kassad was still missing. Saul had told her of the consul's mission. But perhaps the diplomat had returned while the storm raged. Father Duray was unaccounted for. Braun came closer to the glow and paused at the jagged entrance to the monolith. The space inside was expansive and impressive, rising almost 100 meters to a half-sensed skylight roof. The walls, seen from within, were translucent, with what appeared to be sunlight turning them a rich gold and umber. The heavy light fell on the scene at the center of the wide area before her. Thedmon Kassad lay on some sort of stone funeral bier. He was clothed in force-dress black, and his large, pale hands were crossed on his chest. Weapons, unknown to Braun except for Kassad's assault rifle, lay at his feet. The colonel's face was gaunt in death, but no more gaunt than it had been in life. His expression was calm. There was no question that he was dead. The silence of death hung about the place like incense. But it was the other person in the room who had shown the silhouette from afar and who now commanded Braun's attention. A young woman in her mid-to-late 20s knelt by the bier. She wore a black jumpsuit, had short hair, fair skin, and large eyes. Braun remembered the soldier's story, told during their long trip to the valley. Remembered the details of Kassad's phantom lover. "Moneta," whispered Braun. The young woman had been on one knee, her right hand extended to touch the stone next to the colonel's body. Violet containment fields flickered around the bier, and some other energy, a powerful vibration in the air, refracted light around Moneta as well, so that the scene was cast in haze and halo. The young woman raised her head, peered at Braun, rose to her feet and nodded. Braun started to step forward, a score of questions already forming in her mind, but the time tides within the tomb were too powerful and drove her back with waves of vertigo and déjà vu. When Braun looked up, the bier remained. Kassad lay in state under his force field, but Moneta was gone. Braun had the urge to run back to the Sphinx, find Saul, tell him everything, and wait there until the storm abated and the morning came. But above the rasp and whine of wind, Braun thought that she could still hear the screams from the thorn tree, invisible behind its curtain of sand. Pulling her collar high, Braun walked back into the storm and turned up the trail toward the Shrike Palace.
The mass of rock floated in space like a cartoon of a mountain. All jagged spires, knife-edge ridges, absurdly vertical faces, narrow ledges, broad rock balconies, and a snow-capped summit wide enough for only one person to stand there. And he or she only if both feet were together. The river twisted in from space, passed through the multi-layered containment field half a click out from the mountain, crossed a grassy swale on the widest of the rock balconies, and then plunged 100 meters or more in a slow-motion waterfall to the next terrace, then rebounding in artfully directed rivulets of spray to half a dozen minor streams and waterfalls which found their way down the face of the mountain. The tribunal held session on the highest terrace. 17 ousters, 6 males, 6 females, and 5 of indeterminate sex, sat within a stone circle set in the wider circle of rock-walled grass. Both circles held the consul as their locus.
"You're aware," said Freeman Genga, the spokesman of the eligible citizens of the Freeman clan of the Trans-Toral Swarm, "that we are aware of your betrayal."
"Yes," said the consul.
He had worn his finest dark blue bolo suit, maroon cape, and diplomat's tricorn cap.
"Aware of the fact that you murdered Freeman Andil, Freeman Ilium, Cordwell Betts, and Mizinpesh Torrance."
"I knew Andil's name," said the consul softly. "I wasn't introduced to the technicians."
"But you murdered them?"
"Yes."
"Without provocation or warning?"
"Yes."
"Murdered them to take possession of the device which they had delivered to Hyperion. The machine which we told you would collapse the so-called time tides, open the time tombs, and release the Shrike from bondage."
"Yes."
The consul's gaze appeared to be focused on something above Freeman Genga's shoulder, but far, far away.
"We explained," said Genga, "that this device was to be used after we had successfully driven off the hegemony ships, when our invasion and occupation was imminent, when the Shrike could be controlled."
"Yes."
"Yet you murdered our people, lied to us about it, and activated the device yourself years ahead of time."
"Yes."
Melio Arendez and Theo Lane were standing beside and a step behind the consul, and their faces were grim. Freeman Genga folded her arms. She was a tall woman in the classic ouster mode. Bald, thin, draped in a regal dark blue flow suit which seemed to absorb light. Her face was old but almost free of wrinkles. Her eyes were dark.
"Even though this was 4 of your standard years ago, did you think we would forget?" asked Genga.
"No."
The consul lowered his gaze to meet hers. It appeared as if he almost smiled. "Few cultures forget traitors, Freeman Genga."
"Yet you returned."
The consul did not reply. Standing near him, Theo Lane felt a light breeze tug at his own formal tricorn. Theo felt as if he were still dreaming. The ride here had been surreal. 3 ousters had met them in a long, low gondola, floating easily on the calm waters below the consul's ship. With the 3 hegemony visitors sitting amidships, the ouster at the stern had pushed off with a long pole, and the ship had floated back the way it had come, as if the current of the impossible river had reversed itself. Theo had actually closed his eyes as they approached the waterfall, where the stream rose perpendicular to the surface of their asteroid. But when he opened his eyes a second later, down was still down, and the river seemed to be flowing along normally enough. Even though the grassy sphere of the small world hung to one side like a great curved wall, and stars were visible through the 2-meter-thick ribbon of water beneath them. Then they were through the containment field, out of the atmosphere, and their velocity increased as they followed the twisting ribbon of water. There was a tube of containment sphere around them. Logic and the absence of their immediate and dramatic death dictated that there had to be, but it lacked the usual shimmer and optic texture that was so reassuring on Templar tree ships or the occasional tourist habitat open to space. Here there were only the river, the boat, the people, and the immensity of space.
They can't possibly use this as their form of transportation between swarm units,
Dr. Emilio Arendez had said in a shaky voice. Theo had noted that Arendez also was gripping the gunwales with white fingers. Neither the ouster in the stern nor the two seated in the bow had communicated with anything more than a nod of conversation.